to Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust. I'm Paul Gallagher, and this month we're doing something new by doing something old. Rather than discussing a new book, we're going to focus on a classic, which I'm sure many people would call the classic, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Joining me this month are two avowed Gatsby fans, The Skinny Magazine's books editor Keir Hind and Scottish Book Trust's head of programme Sophie Moxon. Welcome to Book Talk. Since I know that The Great Gatsby is a book that both of you have read more than once, we're also going to spend a bit of time discussing what makes a book particularly rereadable, and which books, if any, we like to go back to and read again. And we'd also like to hear your comments on The Great Gatsby and what you think about rereading. Get in touch at facebook.com/booktalksbt or twitter.com/booktalk_sbt or email us at booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com. So, first published in 1925, The Great Gatsby was F. Scott Fitzgerald's third novel and is now far and away his best known and most read. It's told from the perspective of Nick Carraway, who pieces together the events that took place in and around the glamour and decadence of New York in the spring to autumn of 1922, when he met, as he says, the man who gives his name to this book, the mysterious and compelling millionaire Jay Gatsby. Nick and Gatsby share a connection in Daisy Buchanan, the luminous former object of Gatsby's affections, now married to another millionaire, they're everywhere in this novel, Tom Buchanan. As Nick unfolds his story, we learn about these characters and their hopes and their frustrated dreams. It's a story that's big in every way, except its length, a mere 170-odd pages, which only makes Fitzgerald's economic skill more evident. So, on a recent episode of this podcast, the author Ned Bowman referred to The Great Gatsby as the most perfect novel ever written. And when I put out a message earlier today on Twitter asking BookTok followers for their thoughts on the novel, one tweeter called MMP Muskie said, "It speaks to everyone. Jilted lover, man in the middle, new guy, ageless." So I want to start by asking you both, Sophie and Keir, what is it about this novel that causes it to continually gather these kinds of comments from readers and writers alike? Keir, I'm going to come to you first.
Well, the first thing to notice about it is Fitzgerald's prose is excellent. And in every book he wrote, his prose was excellent. But people who write great sentences don't necessarily pile them up into fully formed work of art. And so he slightly misfired these prior two books, and this book he actually gets it properly right, and it all hangs together thematically as well, and so each part complements the other. The sort of tragic part of that is he didn't really do it again. Although people do say good things about Tender as the Night, yeah. Part of it also is it's short, not just because it takes a shorter time to read, because it's very nicely wrapped. It's a very concise and sort of not a word wasted type of book.
Sophie, so do you agree with Kiersek? And what about this comment from this person on Twitter that it appeals to everyone? And they seem to be getting at the point that it was about relationships. That's what this tweeter seemed to think, because what was it they said? Jilted lover, man in the middle, or new guy. So that's a male perspective there. But, you know, like, is there something in here about relationships that seems to be accessible?
I mean, I just see this book as just being this, like, perfect, gorgeous little distillation of all the themes that Fitzgerald writes about. You know, it is this, like, this almost little precious thing in its own right. Thinking about it, I think it's an amazing book, but I don't necessarily see it as an accessible book. I'm not sure these are characters or relationships that I really empathise with. It almost has a kind of mythic quality in a way. Sometimes I see these people as almost archetypes rather than real people. So like I say, it's not a book I see as in a kind of an empathy type of way.
Someone who was talking to me said to me, not a sympathetic character on the entire book. And it's not why I read books.
No, but sometimes that can be a problem. So why is it not a problem?
Because it's not the point. Fitzgerald has very clear kind of goals about what he's writing about. You don't necessarily need to like the characters to see what Fitzgerald's getting at. It's really Fitzgerald that you're following more than anyone.
So obviously, I gave a really brief introduction to the plot. So, Keir, give us a sort of sketch analysis, if you like, of what is it that Fitzgerald is going for then? What is it that we're following?
the start of the book has a piece about Nick Carraway's the narrator. His character isn't particularly strong because he's almost a third person narrator, but he's a removed first person sort of thing, which is kind of one of the innovations of the book, been used before, but this is one of the best examples of that. And he's following from afar the story of Gatsby, who is new money, trying to win Daisy, who is old money. Fitzgerald is examining the climate of the times through these people. The very start of the book has a bit when Nick Carraway says he has some books on the shelf about finance, and they promise to reveal the secrets that Midas and Morgan and Maecenas knew. And that's linking up J.P. Morgan, capitalist extraordinaire, with mythical figures, and it's that kind of blend of myth and money.
You were talking about not liking the characters and not liking the point. We're also thinking about the rereading thing. When I first read this book, when I must have been about 18 or 19, you know, it had this very kind of, you know, this coolness about it. And I have to say, and I'm almost ashamed to say it, I think in a way the characters were slightly aspirational. You know, they had this kind of, this sort of dark, glittery allure to them, you know? The kind of this sort of beautiful, undefinable quality that talked about in terms of Daisy and Gatsby. You know, they had this allure, and I think as a younger reader, I almost kind of skipped over everything that happened. It's just like the idea of, you know, this kind of, this glamour, but with sort of the, you know, the darkness beneath.
When the book first came out, it wasn't actually all that popular. It didn't sell particularly well. Right. Fitzgerald made $8,000 from it, which, not to be sniffed at in the 20s, but as a relative thing, it got $4,000 per short story.
So, right. He's...
attention would have been more financially well earned somewhere else. The book sort of began becoming popular after his death, really.
Right, yeah.
But slightly prior to that, it was on some sort of army reading list. Copies of it were distributed to GIs. Strangely, like 150,000 copies.
That is weird. Thinking about, you know, what this book has to say about the American dream, and just about America as a nation, it's a really odd choice to distribute to people who are serving their nation.
I think there may have been a financial imperative in there as well. The author's just died, the estate needs money, this will be a steal. I don't know that for certain, but that's the implication I would see.
So thinking about that, Sophie, you referred to there, the American dream, which is, and this, Gatsby is often held up as the sort of prime example of the great American novel. How is it that Fitzgerald is successful then? Because I think, just like you said, you can read it and really just be enraptured by the characters, just like you said. So it's not like they're just types that stand in for, you know, there's a story going on there which, at some level, there is a kind of heart. Well, I don't want to say heart, but a humanity to it. But then also, it's able to, people have read it as referring to almost like like Keir was saying, like a kind of mythical perspectives of the American dream. I mean, how does any great book come into being? What is it as you read that sort of is there? Where's the magic in The Great Gatsby? What is making this fire on all cylinders? Sophie, tell us.
Like, my first thought is to go back to the language, but we've already talked about that. I mean, that for me is the thing that endures every time I read it. It is, I've already said it, it is just beautiful. You know, the bits in there that almost make me kind of gasp, you know. Actually, the first time I read this book, I actually wrote down little quotes from it in my notebook.
Have you got an example of something that you would
I've got loads of little post-its in my book.
Open it randomly. Open it randomly and see what jumps out.
Okay, this is I'm ignoring my post-its. I'm going. Okay. Right. Where are we?
Oh, you found the Valley of Ashes.
Talking about mythic. Okay, I'm just gonna read a bit at random to test the theory of this being the perfect book. Okay, this is a Valley of Ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills and grotesque gardens, where ashes take the forms of houses and chimneys and rising smoke, and finally, with the transcendent effort of ash grey men, who move dimly and already crumbling through the powdery air.
In context, that's coming right after scenes of Gatsby's parties.
Yeah.
It's just a fairly sharp contrast that you're getting there.
Yeah. You know, and talking about the American Dream, I think that's, you know, that's one way where he explores it, is the contrast, you know, for instance, between the, you know, the glamour and decadence of the parties, and then, like you say, immediately putting those next to the Valley of Ashes.
And the image of the giant spectacles overlooking, thought that was really powerful. It just really stuck.
I was looking this up earlier today because I kind of almost don't want to know quite so specifically what that means. Mm-hmm. It says a lot to you without you nailing
it. Doesn't it?
I think it probably says more without you nailing. But there's various opinions about it. The one that was kind of fascinating was it's like having the eyes of God watching over, except that it's an advertising hoarding. So it's capitalism has become the substitute there.
It speaks to the economy of his writing, that the power, for like in that example of that image of the spectacles overlooking, the sort of the power is in the fact that you can't quite define what it means, but you know that it means a lot.
The initial title for, or one of the suggested initial titles for the books, was Amongst Ash Heaps and Millionaires, which I think was rejected just because it's a little blatant. And The Great Gatsby was in the end a compromise kind of title. Trimalchio and West Egg is one of the other titles, but that was seen as too obscure. So they sort of gone for a middle ground there.
I thought the Trimalchio one was really interesting because it does put a different slant, because from reading the introduction to my book, I understand that, you know, Trimalchio was this quite vulgar, decadent character who very much sort of participated in the decadence, whereas obviously Gatsby doesn't. You know, he's very much a bystander.
Gatsby doesn't drink.
He doesn't, you know. And also, like, so the fact that Trimalchio is this kind of this vulgar character, again, it was much more kind of blatant, obvious comment on class and social standing as well.
Yeah, the sort of direct comparison there is Trimalchio as new money.
Yeah.
I think he might be a freed slave or something like that, the mythic character Trimalchio. And he hosts parties for the old money people to try and make them like him, effectively, which is where the comparison part comes in. But we're more on Gatsby's side, whereas in the Satyricon, sort of encouraged to look down on Trimalchio, effectively, who is quite a disgusting character.
So that title then would put a completely different slant on the book. If you were somebody who were informed of that, of what that reference meant, you know, you would immediately start the book with a different perspective on Gatsby.
Although Gatsby, I think the point is that Gatsby's not quite that.
Yeah, and I mean, if we can talk then for a minute about Gatsby himself, because we've kind of obviously circled around themes and things. When we get to the end of the book, can we feel that we know him in any way?
I'm not sure we ever can. I mean, we actually are given quite a lot of information about his story. I remember the first time I read it, I was quite surprised by how much we learn about his past, because I thought actually he would have a lot, there would be a lot more mystery around that. But I don't think we ever know him, partly because he actually doesn't say much in the book, and Nick's the narrator, and so obviously we're looking at this quite subjective perspective.
Kia, you said, sort of in contrast to Trimalchio, we're on Gatsby's side.
Gatsby's just a more admirable character, or the narrator admires him. The mystery we have with Gatsby, to some extent, is like, where does he get his money and that kind of thing? And there's murky hints of he's a bootlegger, which he probably is. And he knows the guy who fixed the World Series, which is quite a nice touch. I think, in a sense, we get to know the actual Gatsby. The person that he's been to make all this money isn't really him. The person who was infatuated with Daisy, that's sort of the real Gatsby that comes through in the course of the book. And in the end, Gatsby is all right, as I think Nick says at the start of the book, really.
Can we take what Nick says on face value? You know, like, do you think we're in any way supposed to doubt some of Nick's facts?
No, I don't, really. Partly because Nick's character isn't really there. We're not really given enough of Nick to really make a judgment on his character, other than that he's fairly sound. And Nick also says that one of the few virtues he possesses is honesty. I am one of the most honest men I have ever known, he says, which is obviously what a liar might say. But in context, it does seem right. It does have a very good reporter's eye for the story. He is the one telling us all this.
And actually, right at the beginning of the book, on the very first page, when he introduces himself, he actually says that he always reserves judgment. So he sets himself up to be as objective as possible.
He does show rather than tell. He'll tell you what happened. He won't tell you what his opinion of that particular event was exactly. So he's not really forcing any kind of moral down your throat. That said, if there's one thing in the book that seems a little bit sort of clunky, it's that in order for Gatsby to be slightly admirable, Tom Buchanan has to be just an outright villain. Now, I don't really think it's that clunky. Tom Buchanan is a fully formed character, but not a particularly nuanced one. He is just a bad guy. He's a racist. He's got a mistress. He's violent towards women. He breaks a woman's nose without really thinking too hard about it in one of the early chapters of the book. And therefore, Gatsby cannot but be good by comparison. But that's sort of necessary for the plot, and it doesn't ever grate in any way.
Do you agree with that, Sophie?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's pretty brutal. That's the thing, rereading the book before this, that was when he breaks a woman's nose. That was the first point when I actually thought, this is now a different book for me. I'm reading this differently. I mean, obviously, I read that I read it before.
The sentence actually says that he broke her nose in one movement with an open hand.
Yeah.
Which is like, he actually goes to the point of describing it in some detail. So it's quite clear that he's done it in a casual way.
You know, actually, this is quite a savage, bleak, brutal novel.
Yeah.
In terms of Tom as a character, I mean, I think, you're right, he's not particularly nuanced, but I think he's necessary. You know, I think, you know, and like I say, it adds to this feeling of
and
the archetype.
People
and the mythical
like that do exist.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think
that's probably
the kind of person Fitzgerald may have met.
So, to kind of sum up our thoughts, when we come to the end, what do you kind of take away from Gatsby, and what is it, thinking about rereading, what is it that has drawn you back to think about these characters and to read this story again?
It's a very densely written book, so you're never going to get all of it on one read through. We haven't mentioned this yet, there is quite a lot of colour imagery running through the book, which is very interesting. The books on Midas and Morgan, etc., are red and gold. There's a lot of gold stuff. There's things like yellow cocktail music, which cannot possibly exist. It's to emphasise a sort of insubstantiality to gold and stuff. That's just surface. And it's even been suggested the reason Daisy's called Daisy, it's because a daisy is white, so pure on the outside, and it has that yellow gold at its core. So actually, Daisy's not the ideal that Gatsby's held her up to be. Also, later on in the book, when Gatsby becomes slightly disillusioned with Daisy, he says her voice is full of money.
Yeah.
That sort of insubstantiality of money thing running through it is very, very clever. And to actually get a handle on all that stuff takes quite a bit of reading.
Actually, I think I come back to this book like I come back to a lot of books, because by rereading it and responding to it differently, it's like I'm almost learning something about myself. Other than the fact that I come back to this book because it's absolutely incredible, and I won't mention the language again, but it's really good. Like I say, so when I read it this time, obviously there was no sense of aspiration. There was, you know, these are incredibly sad, bleak characters, and actually, you know, the kind of the glamorous decadent bit, it's actually really quite short before you get into the much darker stuff. You know, by the end of the book, the kind of the concluding events, there's almost a Shakespearean quality to them. You know, it's like this quite a complicated sort of revenge tragedy almost, you know, and there are substitutions, and that really came out at me this time. And like I say, I think it just underlines like the density of the book, and the number of things you can pull out on it. And I bet if I read it in another 10 years or when I'm much, much older, there'll be something else in it as well.
It's clear that there's a lot in Great Gatsby, as we've said. But one thing just to refer to on a much more superficial level is that one of the reasons why we chose this is because there's a new movie version of it in production, which is coming out later this year. And I think now that we've spoken about all, I guess, you know, like the kind of depths of The Great Gatsby in positive terms, of like everything that's in there, you do kind of wonder. So Baz Luhrmann of Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet fame is making a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. It's coming out later this year, Christmas time, I think. Do you think, Sophie, that Baz is going to get under the surface of this movie, or is it really just about that glittering surface? Or, you know, is there a way that the film can really get to the same kind of things that the novel does?
I don't know if it can get quite to the things the novel does, but I have to say, when I first saw a film of Great Gatsby coming out, I automatically went, I would never watch that. It's almost my rule that I never watch films of any books, never mind books that I absolutely adore, you know, and kind of carry with me. Yeah. But then I saw Baz Luhrmann, and I was like, oh my God, because I absolutely love Baz Luhrmann. And I thought, actually, maybe he could do something with it. You know, thinking about what he did with Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet in terms of the music and the visuals, I kind of really hope, actually, that he doesn't do a straightforward period drama.
Yeah.
Surely he won't. You know?
Well, I think it's in 3D. So, you know.
Is the 3D just the thing now, or is he doing something more interesting with it?
I don't know. Kia, what's your take on Baz Luhrmann making a movie of The Great Gatsby?
Well, the book is the language. You cannot get that on screen.
Yeah.
Baz Luhrmann conceivably can use like the visual language of film, but I don't know that you can use it quite in the same way, or quite in a controlled way as you can in a book. There are film adaptations of this. I've never really liked them.
I've seen the Robert Redford one from the 70s, and that seemed to be all about really the period production design and that kind of thing, but not really a lot more.
I think there's a good bit of voiceover because they realise that there's things in the language, but they, you know, there's only so much of that you can do. There's an earlier version with Alan Ladd, which is basically forgotten, and there's, I think, a silent version that was so forgotten no one knows if there's any existing copies left. So it doesn't really have a great history of translating to the screen.
We should also mention, just in terms of random curiosity, while we were preparing for Book Talk, Kia sent us a link to The Great Gatsby, the computer game, which I think was developed for the Nintendo.
No, that's a fake backstory. It's a guy made it just for a joke, basically, and put it up online, and then he pretended it was an unreleased Nintendo game because he made it as a Nintendo game, as an spoof. It's my favourite adaptation of The Great Gatsby. It's actually really well done.
I have to say,
skim
it was
your
real
boaters at waiters.
It was really cool. Like, it's the first time I've played a computer game in probably about 20 years, and actually it looked like the computer games I used to play, so
it's
that was
like
quite
Super
comforting.
Mario,
yeah, yeah, it was great.
And at the end you find the green light and stuff.
Yeah.
The typical nonsense adaptation
the
computer
light
games.
Yeah, the green light. We'll put a link to the game on the Book Talk website. Okay, so thanks, guys. I'm sure there's plenty more to say about The Great Gatsby, and obviously, as you will gather from our discussion, we recommend, if you haven't read it and you think you'll probably go and see the movie later this year, read the book first. And the discussion will continue online, so you can add your comments about The Great Gatsby to the discussion at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk, and also tweet us your thoughts at twitter.com/booktalk_SBT. Find us at facebook.com/scottishbooktrust, or email booktalk@scottishbooktrust.com. I'm Paul Gallagher, and you're listening to Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust, where we're talking about The Great Gatsby with Sophie Moxon from Scottish Book Trust and Keir Hind from The Skinny. So just to finish, I want to spend a few minutes talking about rereading books. We've already mentioned that Gatsby is a book that seems to draw you back to it. And I'm interested from you guys, do you think that there's a particular quality, Sophie, that makes certain books more rereadable? And are you a rereader?
Am I a rereader? I used to be a real rereader. I'm not as much anymore, I think it's because of I'm much more aware of my mortality now with my advancing years, and there are so many books out there, and I do get a bit panicky about whether or not I'm going to read them all. And the piles of unread books are towering around me. But having said that, I do have a little coterie of books that are always on my shelf, and I know they're there, and I will reread them again.
Do you dip in then to books? Do you have a few books that those books you're talking about, would you open up and just read a bit?
Yes, for comfort. So yeah.
What are they? Give us a few examples. What are the books that you
read? The two books by Angela Carter and books by Carson McCullers. The Ballad of the Sad Cafe is my ultimate rereading book, partly because it's short. It's, you know, it's concise. I mean, it definitely is a novella. You wouldn't actually say it's a book. You know, it's actually published on my edition anyway, with a couple of other shorter stories. But it's I guess you could probably say it's a novella. I'm thinking about why I reread them. I thought that actually the sort of linking quality is probably a sense of almost myth and fairy tale. So I don't know whether maybe it's because I find that comforting in some way, or actually it's because they have this kind of universality, is not the right word.
No, but I get it. It's like you were saying with Gatsby, that it's almost like the story is big enough to take your multiple readings, and they can be different.
Different but familiar. Exactly, and that's the comfort of a well reread book. You know, it's somewhere I know I can go, and like I said, I think I've said before, it's a way almost of learning about yourself, but also getting in touch with your past selves as well. You know, thinking when it first came to me, and you know, sort of where I've been since.
So Kia, how about you? What are you a rereader? What's your thoughts on rereading?
Sometimes the kind of thing that I would tend to reread, because I would quite like to read start to finish, would be short stories. Notably Gatsby is the book in Haruki Murakami's Norwegian Wood, the narrator, who's quite close to Murakami himself. He said when he's at a loose end, he just pulls down Gatsby Holmes randomly and reads just a bit. It's a book that very much lends itself to that.
Do you do that with Gatsby?
I've tried it because I've read Norwegian Wood, but it's, you know, a bit studied to do such a thing.
I haven't been much of a rereader, apart from like when I was younger, I used to read the Tintin books over and over and over.
I was funny thinking about how when you're little, rereading is what you do.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're really small, you want to reread the same books again and again, and then that leaves you to a greater or lesser extent the older you get.
Yeah, because like in some ways, I'd like to reread more than I do, because the few times, like a couple of years ago, I reread Michael Chabon's Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, because I really loved it when I first read it, and I sort of was on holiday and thought, I'll just go for it again. And it was so rewarding rereading it, particularly the first half of that book, the recreation of New York in the just before the Second World War. Was just incredible, and I got so much more out of it from reading it a second time, and it made me think I should do this more often, because I don't think I've done justice to a lot of the books I've read, you know. Or
sometimes when you read something and you get more out of it, you kind of feel a bit at fault, like, wait a minute, how did I miss this? That guy died? What? I wondered why he wasn't around for the last 30 pages.
I was thinking that, I don't know if either of you have ever reread something where actually it's disappointed you, because actually you've grown, and I can't think of anything right now, but...
Yeah, well, actually, I do, because having said, there is another book that I've reread, and I wouldn't say it's disappointed me, but it's more like that thing that you were saying, Sophie, that you realise that you're a different person now. And I reread the New York Trilogy by Paul Auster, which was a book I read when I was, like, 16 in high school, and it totally blew my mind. I was like, I didn't know books could be like this, you know, and it really kind of, I think, set me on a particular course of the type of books that I was going to read. And I reread it, and I found, while I could still see the things in it that really amazed me then, I realized that in the intervening years, I've discovered that there's many other writers who do similar and better. But I still think Paul Auster's a great author. I don't want to belittle him, and I still think that's a great book. But it's
because it was First Contact with that stuff.
Yeah. I think I shouldn't have reread it because it would have remained as this really once in a lifetime experience, and now I've realised what it really is. Yeah. It's like The Great Gatsby, you know, not the book, but just that idea of like seeing something for what it really is.
A book I will never reread actually is On the Road, because it's 17 by Jack Kerouac. At 17, that book meant so much to me. And I'm worried that if I read it again, it will devalue it.
I think there's something to be said for that, because if there's a real magic about that first, that thing...
Something of the opposite to this. Anything that I've had to read for school is therefore a nightmare. Anything you have to read to write an essay on, effectively, with a view towards work. But then later on, in fact, that's Gatsby was for me. The first thing was I read it in school and hated it all the way through. And then later on, I read it for university, didn't like it for that, but thought, wait a minute, I should reread this when I have, you know, time to actually read it, and then really enjoyed it. Sunset Song is the one like that. Especially Sunset Song has an interesting, dense first chapter that we were told you won't like that. Immediately, and no one liked it because they were told they wouldn't like it, and then when I went back to it, I thought it was the best part.
Sunset Song is, it's funny you should mention that, because it's what I've been thinking about recently, because I read it in high school and I hated it. Like, I absolutely just couldn't stand it, and recently I've thought, just like you're saying, I think that's probably a good book.
I think it's one that probably improves as you age, because you just get so much more out of it.
Right, okay, that is fantastic. And if you're listening to Book Talk, we'd like to know your thoughts on rereading too. So get in touch with us by all the methods that we've previously mentioned. And also, if you're a Twitter regular, join in our book-related game over at booktalk_SBT every Friday. You may lose an afternoon to the puns, but it will be worth it. Okay, so that's all from Book Talk this month. Next month, we're getting back into new fiction by discussing Jane Harris's Glasgow-set 19th century page-turner Gillespie and I, and S.J. Watson's recent best-selling thriller Before I Go to Sleep. We will analyse whether it's any good or not. Thanks very much to my guests Keir Hind and Sophie Moxon. For Scottish Book Trust, I'm Paul Gallagher. Goodbye. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, music by Sam Gargan.